The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Enjoy ultra-fast speeds up to 10 times faster than Sky's standard broadband.
I was mentioning during the summer that I went on, among other things, a visit to Athy in County Kildare, where there is an amazing and very beautifully formed exhibition to a native of the area, Ernest Shackleton. And our interest was piqued for various reasons, but one of them was because we saw that my next guest this morning was going to be bringing out a book around now on the subject. And to bring it back, we're talking about 1915. We're talking about Ernest Shackleton's attempt to traverse the Antarctic. It was cut short when his ship, the now famous Endurance, became trapped in the ice. And Ranulph Fiennes is one of the few people who would have some idea of what Shackleton went through. Ranulph Fiennes himself walked across the Antarctic in 1992. He's been involved in numerous polar expeditions. According to the Guinness Book of Records, he's the world's greatest explorer. So you have to ask yourself, who better to write a biography of Ernest Shackleton, who is, of course, a polar explorer, a charmer, an egotist, a chancer, an Irishman, all of these things. Let's talk more with our guest, Ranulph Fiennes. Good morning, Ranulph.
Very good morning, Ryan. I have to say that the critics of Shackleton have constantly said that if his ship had not sunk and had managed to reach his target, a place called Vahsel Bay,
yes,
which was the beginning of 900 miles of unknown Antarctica, unknown completely, it's bigger than America with no Tesco's en route, he would have died if the ship had not sunk to stop him trying. That's what would have happened to Shackleton. He would have got to the pole, probably, and he would have got down to the other side, probably, and reached the depot that his other people would have dropped off for him to stop starvation. That was his plan, but the critics say it would have failed. He wanted to cross Antarctica, so the fact that his ship sunk meant that the whole expedition had failed.
Amazing.
Didn't even set out, never mind cross it. But as far as we, the so-called experts, could prove, was that he would have been able, mathematically, on nutritional basis, to have reached the pole and still been alive, got down the Beardmore Glacier on the other side, and reached Mount Hope, where his depot would have been dropped off. Well, it was dropped off. Those guys, three of them died horribly doing it. Nobody could tell them that they were doing it for nothing because his ship had sunk and he wouldn't ever get there. So if you're still with me, Ryan.
Of course, Sam.
Dr. Stroud and I did the entire journey from Berkner Island, just next door to where he would have been dropped off, made it to the pole. At the pole, I realized we were going to die, and we had no dogs, of course, to help like he did. And we weren't people like they were in those days. We were modern people and therefore not as tough as Shackleton and his men. And yet we made it to the pole and then decided, because Mike was really interested in how we were starving, I lost 55 pounds in 93 days despite eating 7,000 calories a day. And we just made it alive to Mount Hope, where the depot was. And we proved that that wonderful Irish guy, Shackleton, would have succeeded if his ship had not sunk.
Amazing. And QED. The Irish element to this story, of course, is interesting to our listeners, Ranulph. And you outline that lineage in your book about Ernest Shackleton. Maybe talk us through as much as you can about that part of his story.
Yeah, well, at that time, two Irishmen set out almost the same year. One of them, very, very cold hero, and he really was a hero, Shackleton, and the other one, equally Irish, Lawrence of Arabia, an amazing hot success story. And the Anglo-Irish, as they were sort of called by many of the biographers earlier on, they highlighted his the way he would speak Irish when it suited him, the accent. And he was, in many ways, what is considered to be typically Irish, i.e. lucky, the Irish luck, which he called Providence, or Provi was his word. Mm. And it really did work for him. Another word is cats with nine lives. And both of those guys, those Irish guys, had nine lives or more.
I don't know if you learnt from Shackleton for your own story, but certainly the explorers of in Shackleton's ear seem to spend a lot of time with the bowl out saying, believe in us, and fundraising. Like in the equivalent day and age, they'd have a GoFundMe page set up on an internet somewhere. But it is a lot of it. Their time was spent looking for money.
Absolutely. And we had a firm rule. My wife, Ginny, who I knew since she was 9 and I was 12, we had a firm rule that we would never pay anybody anything for anything, services or equipment. That's why we had 1,900 sponsors. Mm-hmm. All the 7 years that we worked on organising it, we worked at weekends in pubs to make a living to pay the gas bill.
And what is the philosophy behind that, that idea of saying we will pay for nothing?
It is not Irish, it is Scottish. It's the best way of being mean.
But I suppose it keeps you in... I mean, you're being jocose about it, but the bottom line is it means you're not worrying about debt, you're worrying about the expedition.
That's exactly right. And Shackleton, after glory, as we were saying earlier on, whenever he made a lot of money, because he was a wonderful lecturer, and he... gave the money, whether he was lecturing in New Zealand or Australia or UK or America, he gave large sums of money, even though he was in debt, to the local charity in the place where he was lecturing to. Because that, you know, helped your glory, and why not? But it wasn't good for the people he owed money to, and that was on the bad side. And in my book, I've stressed what you might call the wonderfully good, heroic side. And like every human being, he had one or two bad ones, and one was debt.
Will you take us through as much as you can? I mean, obviously, the book is there and available. People will, of course, read it. But in terms of Shackleton, what, for you, Rana Fines, was his, dare I say it, enduring appeal, but certainly his greatest achievement, and why?
His mentality was just so, so powerful. I've studied an awful lot of people who've done things in polar regions and in war, and I've never come across a man who was able to defeat the negative side of his brain. When the wimpish voice came into his head saying he can't take it anymore, he would fight it in his head. And not only on behalf of himself, but on behalf of all the miserable people, his men, who were suffering vastly as he was. And he could somehow fight it, even though physically he had various things wrong with him from the start, including an asthmatic state, which is particularly not good at a high altitude like Antarctica can be, and also heart problems. So that is what I admire most. Started with various things which would make him, you know, really not chosen. And he knew that his own doctor, who he made check everybody else, he wouldn't allow his doctor to check him and his heart state.
Can you explain for listeners who aren't familiar with the Shackleton story, explain what happened with Endurance and the crew?
His ship sunk in the Weddell Sea, which was quite likely. Every year, it was known back then, 100 years ago, and he died 100 years ago, pretty much to the year, that the Weddell Sea could sink any ship very quickly if it happened to go that way that year, depending on the way the wind was blowing, really, and the current was dragging. So he made everybody get the three big lifeboats off and everything that they could survive on the ice floe. And I've floated with Charlie Burton by mistake, I didn't mean to, for 8 months on an Arctic ice floe in exactly the same way. And it was the same horrible outlook, except we had polar bears, whereas in Antarctica, that's one thing he didn't have. Had lots of penguins and seals to keep them eating. And they floated, and he planned to use the three boats on skids and to tow everything to the nearest land on Paulet Island. But that didn't work because the ice floes is too bumpy and the snow is too deep. and they couldn't haul the weight of the boats, so they put the tents up on a nearby floe and continued to float until they got, eventually summer came, and they managed to get into open water. But the open water, where there was no ice keeping the waves down, was horrific, as everybody knows, like the furious 50s. Mm. They're just 100-foot high waves, one of which that high, probably caused by a big iceberg dropping over at night, hit the sea and got a huge wave which very, very nearly sunk Shackleton's ship, boat, I mean. What they were doing eventually was to get to a little island called Elephant Island, and therefore that saved their lives. And he dropped off everybody but himself and five others. Mm. And they made a rescue attempt to get somewhere where there were humans with boats. And that in itself was a really frightful 17-day and night journey. I can't imagine anything worse than that. Wet and very, very cold and about to sink, and trying to eat in a boat that's constantly going up and down, try and make hot milk. And they got to Elephant Island, but nobody would ever rescue them from there, so he left everyone, and he and the carpenter McNish and the great Worsley, who's a wonderful navigator, navigating on a boat where your sextant isn't going to get the sun to behave itself and get the bubble correct on your sextant, but he did. Mm. And he just, like hitting a dartboard in the right place, managed to get to where there were Norwegian whalers back at South Georgia, where they'd set out from nearly 2 years previously. And he then got five different ships just in time to get back to collect his men from Elephant Island. A wonderful rescue operation. So his expedition had entirely failed. He hadn't set out. But his reputation is just brilliant, and it's a star that shines, and Ireland should be proud of him. So should all of the UK.
Indeed, and of course there's another Irishman in the middle of it all by the name of Tom Crean.
He was one of the very best, and Crean went right to the end, and Crean was in that boat I've just been telling you about. When they got to South Georgia, I should mention that they managed to get from the wild side over 4,000 and more high mountain range never crossed before, and then down the other side. And if they'd been there one more day, they would have died in a storm. That's another example of probby.
Was he particularly lucky compared to other explorers, or was he an excellent strategist, or was it that glorious combination of the two?
When you go to try and break polar records, as I know only too well, you must not count on luck, but you must hope for luck.
Okay.
Because you're in an area where it could go one way or the other, the behaviour of the enemy, that's the ice.
And when you were a young boy and into your teens, was Shackleton a figure in your life, Ranulph, or was that later in life?
No, my dad, who was killed in the war commanding a tank regiment against Rommel 4 months before I was born, and Mum told me all about Dad, and I wanted to do what he did in the same famous Scottish regiment. I wanted to be colonel of it in my day. But my first 12 years were actually spent in South Africa, and I didn't get A-levels and couldn't go to Sandhurst College, so I could only get a short service commission. And I didn't start doing expeditions until after my 8 years maximum allowance in the British Army. At that point, I married Jenny, and we wanted to make some money.
When you were kicked out of the Army, is it true that it involved explosives on the set of the film Dr. Doolittle?
Yes, it is true. I was chucked out of the SAS because a friend of mine who had been at Eton had become, like most of them, a wine salesman in the West Country. And during selling pubs in a beautiful village, which had just been voted by the Americans as Europe's prettiest, he discovered that 20th Century Fox were making a movie in this lovely village called Dr. Doolittle, which involved turning the lovely stream into a dirty great lake for filming, a 20-foot concrete dam to make the lake, ruining this lovely village. And my friend decided to bring this public outrage to the general attention by blowing up the concrete dam the night before the film started. Good PR plan. The police, unfortunately, got to hear about it. They put Alsatian dogs all over the dam. but my friend had been at Eton, so he was up to that one. What he did was to rent 8 Alsatian bitches in order to put them upwind of the dam where the police dogs were. Unfortunately, the bitches never turned up. They were rented. And so he rang me up to ask if I would stand in. And I had just completed an army explosives course.
Yes.
Where you learn to blow up as much as you can using as little as possible. And I was quite good at this. I had a lot left over at the end of every day. And I thought, you know, a good way of getting rid of it was this public-spirited gesture. I was not caught. Everyone else was caught on our team. I was not caught because I'd been doing another army course on how to escape from dogs by night.
Okay. I don't think I'll ever see that film the same way again, Ranulf. That is a good story, I have to say. I want to ask you about that word you mentioned called polar hular.
Yeah, polar hular. It's sort of Scandinavian Norwegians. We, over the 70s, 80s and 90s, our team breaking different unsupported polar records in the Arctic, we've always found the rivals are the Norwegians. It's one of their words. Mm. We don't call them rivals. We call them enemy in order that our group does harder to break that exact same record that we're doing next. And polar hula means once you've got the hang of wanting to do polar records, geographical and physical records, then it gets stuck in your mind and your brain and you can't get away from it. It's a great desire, a magnetic want to get back to the polar regions, polar hula.
And did you have an acute case of polar hula since you were young?
I think I probably did in the DNA, really. But there are other sides to the expeditions which we have done. I've mentioned the scientific side, including my wife's stuff and Dr. Michael Stroud's medical stuff on starvation of the human body. But we also have made money for chosen charities like Multiple Sclerosis, 4 million. Altogether, we've made 18.9 million out of the expeditions, thanks to the generous public answering the multiple sclerosis, Marie Curie cancer care, breakthrough breast cancer, and the British Heart Foundation. 18.9 million.
Extraordinary figure. Congratulations on that, to say the least. Ranulf Fine, what a pleasure to talk to you this morning. Your book is fascinating, and no better man, like I said at the beginning of our conversation, to write about the subject. Shackleton, a biography by yourself, by Ranulf Fine, is published by Penguin, rather appropriately. And that is a book that will find itself, I suspect, at the bottom of the tree for many people this Christmas, if I may not hex things by saying that too early. All right, that's where we'll leave that for now. Our text number, as always, 51551.